Welcome to Camp Constitution Radio with your host, Hal Shurtleff. This show is heard on WBCQ, The Planet, every Monday night at 7:30 Eastern Standard Time. And it is also rebroadcast on IPMNation.org. And the show, I think, is rebroadcast at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It is based out of Concord, New Hampshire. They changed the times. It used to be 4 o'clock, and they changed the times, but we're glad that they have us on. And this Camp Constitution Radio is brought to you by Camp Constitution, which, among other things, runs a week-long family camp. This year's camp is in, as it's always been, in beautiful Ringe, New Hampshire, at Towanippe Christian Retreat Center. The camp runs from July 10th to the 17th, and we are very pleased that Mrs. Chris Ann Hall is returning for her third year and give us some classes. Mr. John McManus will also be on hand, and many other fine instructors, and all kinds of great activity, a lot of fun. We're going to be taking an all-day field trip to Lexington Green, Lexington, Massachusetts, and the Concord Bridge. We have local historian Tom Moore to narrate the events, and we'll probably take a trip to the Buckman Tavern, where the Lexington Minuteman muster prior to running on the green. That's where they congregated. And the Hancock Clark House, the home of Jonas Clark, the member of the Black Robe Regiment. You can find out about our camp at campconstitution.net, the website. And, I know this show was heard in, actually all over the world, but you're thinking, well, it's, New Hampshire's a long way to go. Well, while we can't guarantee you a carpool, we'll do our best to help get you there. We can pick people up at train stations and airports and bus stations, and we have folks coming from the Midwest and from the South. Some cases they drive, and so we can look at carpool opportunities for that as well. And we're having expecting a guest to call in, Mrs. Jessica Vaughn of the Center for Constitutional Studies, but Center for Immigration Studies. And immigration issue, of course, it's an important issue. It's been a issue on a lot of people's minds. I think our candidate from Florida, the U.S. senator, who just recently dropped out of the campaign, he was one of the members of the Gang of Eight. I don't think that helped his cause any. The Gang of Eight were U.S. senators that supported open borders and immigration policies. And I think that really hurt his Marco Rubio. And I know that hurt his chances, as it should be, among patriots and pro-Americans. And I've got a friend of mine, and I respect his opinion on many issues. But he's recently embraced this sort of an open borders idea. And I think it's sort of this libertarian philosophy. And while I agree with a lot of libertarian principles and beliefs, this particular open borders is really unsustainable. And if you just simply do the thinking, you'd say, well, how can a nation stay a nation and be sovereign if we don't have any control over our borders? I have the opinion that the immigration policy should be based on what's best for the American people, the American citizens. If we need so many engineers or doctors or laborers or what have you, then the policy should be based on that. A policy shouldn't be based on some type of open door, everybody welcome, we don't care who you are, come on in. We have been historically the most generous nation when it comes to immigration in the history of the world, folks. About 1 million every year come from all over the world to come here legally. And I'm actually of the opinion I think we have too many people here legally, especially when the job opportunities for Americans isn't what it should be. And this idea that, well, there are jobs that Americans won't do, I don't believe that, because I travel around the region and I see lots of people, young people, working in restaurants and sweeping and doing house cleaning and these alleged jobs that Americans won't do. I get up to Arista County, of course, where the radio station's based, and I actually see migrant workers from Mexico, all the way from Mexico, picking potatoes and other crops. And I'm thinking, why is it so difficult? I mean, there's unemployment. People are moving out of the county, Arista County, when there's opportunities here. I mean, when I was growing up in Boston, in the city, if you said, gee, Hal, you have a chance for a couple of weeks to work picking apples or come up to Maine for a couple of weeks, I would have looked forward to that. I would have been excited about that. So I can't imagine that from Mexico all the way to Maine, and you have to house these migrant workers and pay them. They don't probably get paid a whole lot. You think it'd be a little less expensive simply to hire some young people or middle-aged people or semi-retired people, what have you, right from the communities. Anyway, I think our guest is on the line. Jessica, is that you?
Yes, it is. Good evening.
Good evening. I'm so honored to have you on. Let me read your bio from your website. Jessica Vaughn serves as Director of Policy Studies for the Center for Immigration Studies, a Washington, D.C.-based research institute that examines the impact of immigration on American society and educates policymakers and opinion leaders on immigration issues. She has been with the center since 1992. That's quite a stretch there, a long time. And her area of expertise is immigration, policy, and operations, covering topics such as visa programs, immigration benefits, and immigration law enforcement. Ms. Vaughn recently completed several major projects on immigration and crime, including a Department of Justice-funded project studying the use of immigration law enforcement and transnational gang suppression efforts. In addition, she is an instructor for senior law enforcement officer training seminars at Northwestern University Center for Public Safety in Illinois. Well, do you have time for anything else, it looks like? Prior to joining the center, Mrs. Vaughn was a Foreign Service officer with the State Department, where she served in Belgium and Trinidad and Tobago. That's kind of too interesting. What a contrast there. Her articles have appeared in the Washington Post, Boston Globe, Boo Hiss, when it comes to Boston Globe. I'm surprised they run your things. The Economist, in the National Interest, Providence Journal, Harvard Current, Arizona Republic, and other publications. And it can be found at www.cis.org. That's the Center for Immigration Studies. She has testified before Congress several times and advised state lawmakers and agencies on immigration issues. She is frequently cited in news media reports on immigration and has appeared on NPR, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, and PBS's NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Mrs. Vaughn has a master's degree from Georgetown University and earned her bachelor's degree in international studies at Washington College of Maryland. Well, welcome to Camp Constitution Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I wanted to address this issue, which has been coming up recently. And libertarians, and I love them. I love a lot of what they stand for, but I think more than a few of them have embraced this idea of open borders. And one of them, who's a friend of mine, recently said that it was always the states that handled immigration laws, and that naturalization under Article 1 of the Section 8 of the Constitution doesn't really mean immigration. Could you give me a little sort of a history of our immigration laws and policy?
I don't agree with that. It's clear that the founders recognized that it would not do to have, at that time, 13 different immigration policies, nor today could we manage with 50 different immigration policies. It's just simply not something that lends itself to state control, because the states can't control who goes back and forth between the borders of the states, and it is a federal matter. I mean, we're talking about people coming into the United States and becoming citizens, and that has to be defined and managed by the federal government. So this
now
is clearly something that is a federal matter.
And it's always been that subject. Now, I know that people may have come into the port of Boston or the port of New York and so forth, but it was always under the federal, in other words, Congress always had that power to deal with immigration and naturalization.
That's right, and it is, you're correct to point out that it is Congress, not just the federal government, that the founders wanted to give control of immigration policy to. It is it's called plenary power, and immigration law is what Congress says it is. And the executive branch's responsibility is to execute faithfully the immigration laws that Congress enacts. And it's not up to the judicial branch to make decisions about who can, be admitted as an immigrant or, other similar matters. It's, the immigration law is what Congress says it is.
And also when it comes to refugee status, and of course, I sympathize, and I think you do, and most good Americans sympathize with the plight of refugees, but there's certain qualifications. Just because you may have been a revolution in your country and you're now claiming refugee status, but you may not be someone we want in this country. There are laws. I know Congress has made laws defining things like that. I think of young Elian Gonzalez. Now, it was interesting that he most likely qualified for immigration for refugee status. His poor mother died on a raft, a leaky raft coming over here, and he had people to take care of him. Yet all of a sudden, the Clinton administration had all of a sudden become guardians of the Constitution, and he needs to go back with his father, of course, into the hands of Fidel Castro. And you remember the boat lift in Cuba back in the early 80s, where I think it was the Secretary of State, Alexander Haig, said that he would like to see these people put back on an expendable vessel back to Cuba. But
I don't remember that quote. But
they don't remember that? Yeah, that was a little politically incorrect, I think. Tell us about your organization and the important work it does. And I know you speak, you travel around the country. Other than that impressive resume, I happen to hear you speak at a Tea Party gathering in Northborough, Massachusetts, where you're sort of a regular, and you are the Boston area or Massachusetts?
I do. I live in Franklin, Massachusetts.
Okay. That's where my daughter goes to school, Dean College. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's a great place, and the Center for Immigration Studies is based in Washington, D.C., and we have most of our staff there because that's where immigration policy is made. So that's where we are and where, most other similar think tanks are located. And we put out reports and we speak to groups and we talk to the media and we work with lawmakers both at the federal level and the state level. And our mission is to educate the public and lawmakers about the implications of immigration policy and what the effects of immigration policy are on the United States of America, with the perspective of trying to inform a policy that puts the national interest as the top priority rather than special interests. Immigration policy ought to be good for our country, not just for immigrants, not just for the people who want to hire them. That's not just for people who want to bring in family members, but it's supposed to advance our national interest.
You would think that, in other words, the Congress, they take an oath to defend the Constitution. And yes, under the Constitution, they can go out, they can let 100 million people in tomorrow if they voted for it and the president signed it into law, and I'm sure he would. But the basis should be what's in the best interest for the American people in the nation at large. Will it benefit the American people? That should be the very first question. Not would it benefit Syria, not would it benefit Mexico or the international community, but should it benefit the United States of America as a sovereign nation? That should be the very first issue. Now, Donald Trump, running for president, said something about Muslims, and he said that he would put a moratorium on that. What is your organization's position on that?
Well, we don't think that that's exactly the right way to go about it, that to try to bar people based on their religion it's not practical, and it probably wouldn't be as effective as we would want it to be. What we definitely need to do a better job of screening, but we think that screening should be focused on keeping out people who are a threat for terrorism, for national security, and that's going to be more, there are other ways to address that other than in simply barring all people of a particular religion? You know, because there are Muslims who come from parts of the world that are not associated with terrorism as much.
Yes.
And, you know, people would, you know, I can't tell a Muslim by looking at them. If, you know, if we based it on religion, that's something that people could lie about. You know, wear the trappings of other religions to try to deceive people. I mean, we just think that there are better ways to go about it, that would not be the most effective way. We definitely need to do a lot better job of screening people, though. Now, with respect to refugees, we think that right now we simply shouldn't be taking any refugees from Syria at all because of the difficulty in screening them.
Now, what about a nation that has been identified by the State Department as an official sponsor of terrorism? For example, I think Libya, I don't know if it's still but it was for a while. And then, in other words, people who are citizens in good standing in these countries would not be allowed to immigrate here. Has that been a policy of this country?
No, we do not bar all individuals from any particular country, but we do, well... Right now, we don't do enough to try to screen out potential threats coming from those countries. I think right now our admissions policies are far too generous, particularly with respect to some of these countries associated with terrorism. And the most recent example of that is the terrorist attack in San Bernardino, California, where we gave very little screening to a guy who was associated with a terror plots in the United States already and wanted to apply for his wife to come in on a fiancé visa. And there was very little screening done of her, too. I mean, it's clear that we need to screen not only the people who are applying, but also the people who are trying to sponsor them, and that if they had made a little bit more effort, there might very well have been clues that were uncovered that showed what a risk it would have been to allow these people in. But, you know, under Obama administration policies, officers were not allowed to look at social media. They don't screen the sponsors. They don't do full background checks. And their mission is, as it is explained to them by policy, is to make it as easy as possible for new immigrants to go through the process and get here. They don't want to do anything in that processing that would slow it down too much. And, security has been less of a priority than admitting people.
Now, on the subject of illegal immigration, what are the current numbers? Now, I've been hearing that there's fewer illegals over the last few years. So what are the numbers of illegals currently in the United States?
It's right around 12 million. Well, we put out reports on this. I have a colleague who does the population analysis, and he puts out studies. He uses Census Bureau data and other sources to come up with an estimate of how many people are here illegally in the United States. Now, obviously, people here illegally don't, you know, always fill out a census form, so he adjusts for an undercount, but you'd be surprised how many of them do fill out a census form because state and local governments really want to count every person living in their jurisdiction because a lot of federal money is based on that. So, you know, you can get to a pretty good point and know how many people are there, and then we use other ways to filter out who's here illegally. And our estimates are very, very close to what the Department of Homeland Security has done with far better data than we have access to. And also some other kind of pro-immigration think tanks have a similar estimate. So we think it's probably about as accurate as we can get. But, you know, it's interesting. The numbers have not been going down. They have been pretty steady for the last several years. They were going down from about 2007 to 2009 because at that time the Bush administration had really stepped up enforcement and a number of state governments had enacted pretty tough state laws to help with immigration enforcement, and the economy was not good. So all those three factors together meant that there were, you know, people were leaving on their own as well as being deported. So the size of the illegal population did drop for, I think, the first time probably in very many decades. But then under Obama administration policies, they put the brakes on deportations, and so the population has stabilized, even though the economy hasn't really recovered. But there aren't very many people who are trying to go home on their own who feel any threat of deportation or, you know, like there's any reason for them to go home because they can live here as if they're legal. They can,
and they'll be pretty much unmolested. They won't be troubled by ICE or any enforcement. Now, about 25 years...
No, the president himself has said that unless they are convicted of a very serious crime, he doesn't want to deport them.
Now, living in Greater Boston, living in the city of Boston all my life, except the time I was in the service, up until about 20, even 15 years ago, it didn't seem to be a big issue in Boston. But maybe over the last 10 years, we see more evidence of illegal immigration and crimes committed by illegal aliens and so forth. Where would be the largest, with your organization, where would they determine the largest percentage of illegal aliens? Is it California, Southern California?
California has the largest population and probably the largest percentage as well. The other top states are Texas, Florida, New York, and Illinois, and then surprisingly, Georgia and North Carolina also have very large numbers.
It is surprising. You think states like North Carolina, but is it because the state government is just very lax and not really doing anything to enforce or making an effort to make it hard for illegals to come into the state?
Actually, those two states have among the toughest laws in the country for state governments to help.
Really?
But I believe there are a couple reasons. One is that their economies were very strong and there were jobs to be had. And secondly, the cost of living there is less than in many other parts of the country, certainly less than California, New York, you know, Chicago, and places like that. So they can live very, you know, economically. And
the climate's a little bit better than it is in Illinois or New York as well, too. So,
well, I kind of like winter, but some people might say, you know, if you're from Central America or Mexico, you might think that it's more hospitable.
You don't like it. Yeah, the idea of winter is it gets to be 60 degrees, you know.
Right.
So there's lots of problems with legal immigration, the infrastructure, the cost. But there's also the high cost of the crime that many illegals are committing. The very fact that they're here is a federal crime, but we're talking about violent crime. Do you have statistics about how many illegals are murdering people, raping, and these serious crimes like this?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. We do know from federal statistics that there are about 2 million criminal aliens now living in the United States, now inside the United States.
That's a disproportionate number of the population of illegal aliens, isn't it?
Well, it isn't really. I have found through a lot of research on this question that illegal aliens, despite the fact that you correctly point out that it is a crime for them to have come here illegally and to stay here illegally, but they don't commit other types of crime any more or less than anyone else. But the problem is that they're associated with certain types of crimes, and so that causes problems. Most of the growth in criminal gang activity in the United States has come through gangs that have a lot of illegal aliens as members, and that's gotten worse with the influx of Central American young people in the last couple of years. I mean, we saw in Boston just a few weeks ago, they arrested about 56 members of a very brutal street gang, MS-13, and I understand that they were all non-citizens, and some of them were recent illegal arrivals. But it is a public safety problem. I mean, the fact that illegal immigration increases the number of criminals, even if it's the same proportion as crime among natives, it means there's more criminals here than they should be, and you know, anybody is potentially subject to deportation if they're here illegally, but the criminals ought to be the top priority. And there have been some very tragic incidents lately that have resulted specifically because of obstructing immigration enforcement, whether it's by the Obama administration or by a sanctuary jurisdiction. So it's something that we can't ignore. You know, crime is not a job Americans won't do. There's no reason to let people who are here illegally and committing other crimes stay here. They should be, you know, they should get a front seat on the deportation transportation out of the country.
I'm glad you brought up the sanctuary city issue, because how many of these so-called sanctuary cities are there in the United States offhand?
There are, at last count, there were more than 300.
300?
Yes, at one point there were 340, according to the Department of Homeland Security. Some jurisdictions have dropped those sanctuary policies for various reasons, mostly because it was resulting in too many criminals being released back into our communities instead of deported. But now the Department of Homeland Security is kind of clammed up on what the exact number is. So if I'm a mayor
or a member of the city council, usually they pass some type of resolution declaring themselves to be sanctuary cities, saying that they will illegal aliens are welcome here. Last time I understood, isn't that a crime? Isn't that a criminal offense?
It can be, yes. It's one thing to just sort of say, oh, well, we're welcoming of immigrants. That's fine. That's a political statement, really, more than anything else. But there are jurisdictions, some of them here in Massachusetts, including the cities of Cambridge and Somerville, and even the city of Boston has a kind of mild sanctuary policy, but it is a sanctuary policy. If they obstruct communication between local officers and ICE, for example, by telling local police that they cannot turn someone over to ICE if they discover someone they arrest is here illegally, that's a sanctuary policy, and that's in violation of federal law. If they ignore ICE detainers, when ICE gets a notification that a criminal alien has been arrested, somebody who's here illegally is in local custody for local crimes, they'll send what's called a detainer to that jurisdiction and say that they want them to hold them until they can, you know, pick them up at the end of their sentence. If a local sheriff refuses that communication, that's a sanctuary policy, because they're deliberately shielding an illegal alien from deportation, and that's in violation of federal law.
We just have a few minutes left. I want to ask you, do you recall the police chief of New Ipswich, New Hampshire?
Yes, I do.
You recall that? I got a chance to meet him, and that was a very interesting angle. He arrested him for trespassing. We got another minute. Just elaborate on that, and then you can let the listeners know where they can find information about your organization, and maybe have you speak to their group or someone from your group.
Yeah, that was a creative approach. He charged them with the local crime of trespassing because they had no permission to be there and wanted to prosecute them, and then they would have been subject to deportation. But, you know, the whole industry of illegal alien advocacy groups lawyered them up, and the Mexican government got involved and paid for their attorneys, as I recall, to try to get the charges dismissed from the local courts, and, you know, surprise, a judge went along with it. But, you know, the thing is that we talked about how it's a federal issue, but the cost of illegal immigration falls mainly on state and local taxpayers. And
that's right. It's
a good thing for state and local governments to do what they can to discourage illegal settlement and to help the federal government enforce immigration laws for that very reason. It's the local communities that suffer.
So where can people find out about your organization, and maybe a phone number you'd like to give that out to?
Sure. Our website is www.cis.org, and all of our material is on there. I hope people will take advantage of that. I'm on Twitter at @JessicaV_CIS. The phone number of our office is area code 202-466-8185.
Thank you for being on. God bless you and your efforts, and thank you for listening. Camp Constitution Radio on WBCQ The Planet.
Thank you.